First of all, I want to apologize for the overly long bio and the lack of an abstract in the conference handbook, and I hope I'll make up for it in my talk. I've been asked to talk about three decades of family involvement, and that period actually spans my own involvement as a mental health professional and as a family advocate in the evolution and the legitimization of a family role in mental health services and policy. So I'm going to speak about those 30 years in historical perspective, interspersed with a few personal recollections. And some of these will bring into sharp focus how far we have come. Any discussion of family involvement necessarily applies to the whole diagnostic array of serious mental illnesses. And this, of course, includes, but is not limited to, borderline personality disorder. Family involvement specifically in BPD is a fairly recent development, and we'll talk about that later at greater depth from both services and advocacy perspectives. For many years, when professionals discuss family involvement in any kind of mental illness, and specifically, of course, in BPD, it was in terms of faulty child-rearing practices or dysfunctional family systems. That emphasis is now largely diminishing. Increasingly, the family is being recognized as an important support system. There's growing acknowledgement in the field, emphasized in the President's new Freedom Commission on Mental Health report, that families need to be involved in the treatment system. Rather than being omitted from the therapeutic process, as in the past, family members need education, support, and coping techniques to help their loved ones. And research clearly shows that when family members get that kind of support from professionals, professionals see positive results in their patients. But families are concerned about more than treatment alone. They're also concerned about societal stigma and the difficulties of their loved one in obtaining or maintaining jobs, housing, insurance, and other amenities of life. They're concerned about scarce resources for services and research. They want scientific studies that may clarify why and how their loved one became ill and how this disease can be prevented for future generations. And they want to resolve the puzzlement and confusion of their own role. And they want a mental health system that is adequately staffed and willing to communicate and answer their questions. So in this presentation, we'll look at family involvement from two levels, the individual case level and the societal level. The first refers to families' involvement in the treatment of a loved one, the development of interventions aimed at helping patients and their families understand and cope with the illness. And the second involves families' participation as stakeholders in the service system as a whole. It means political advocacy for more resources, for services and research. It has also come to mean families' participation in mental health planning, governance, and sometimes service delivery. In recent years, families have also had a role in educating the mental health professionals who treat their loved ones, in helping them understand the day-to-day experience of living with mental illness. Political advocacy can mean more than simply lobbying legislatures to increase funding and programs. For this particular audience, it should also involve efforts to develop incentives for mental health professionals to learn more about those patients whom they find most difficult and whom they least like to treat, people with BPD. So I feel that the two perspectives are very much interrelated. Members of advocacy groups, by pressuring for more basic research and for careful studies of more client-sensitive and family-sensitive interventions, have helped change theoretical as well as therapeutic models. Over the past decade, they've brought both needed funding and fresh insights into the service systems that treat their loved ones. And meanwhile, we have forward-looking professionals like Perry Hoffman and other colleagues here, who have not only developed and studied new therapeutic models for helping families, but have recognized the importance of partnering and helping families to organize their own advocacy group for BPD. But things weren't always like this. During the 1970s and early 1980s, I served on our county and state mental health planning boards. These boards, which funded the whole array of mental health services, were mandated by law to have adequate representation for race and ethnicity, a long overdue and commendable goal. They were also expected to have representation from the school system, from the courts, the criminal justice systems, from the financial sector, so we would have budget experts, and various other sectors. So we had a lot of judges and bankers and lawyers and school teachers and certified accountants, many of whom knew little about mental illness. But of course, the mandate also included representation of both mental health professionals and service providers, and I served as a psychologist, as a professor, and director of a community mental health center at that time. Yet as someone who had experienced mental illness in her own family, I was probably the only person there who knew the system inside out from both sides of the bridge. In fact, at that time, the mental health boards represented everybody but the actual recipients of services, and I protested. Why, I asked, is there no mandate for representation of patients and their families, for the very people whose lives are most vitally affected by our decisions? No answer, and rather shocked astonishment at the question. Patients planning their own services, family members who were still considered etiological agents, planning treatment systems for the very disorders they had caused. A decade or so later, of course, representation of consumers and family members became a requirement for funding, but that was only after years of advocacy and the political growth of family involvement. At the same time, proliferating research showed such powerful evidence of biological and genetic substrates that the idea of parental causation of these complex disorders began to seem simplistic and non-productive. Ensuing research indicated that families, like other persons in the patient's orbit, could be trained to alter their reactions and behaviors to accommodate the illness without any need for causal attributions, and I'll elaborate on this further on. We've now reached the point where the President's Commission on Mental Health states that the mental health system should be driven by the needs of consumers and family members, and it calls for family psychoeducation in its recommended array of evidence-based services. The Department of Mental Health of the state of Ohio now mandates their facilities to involve families in treatment. And SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Administration, mandates that 50% of the members of state mental health planning boards must be stakeholders, consumers and family members, the actual recipients of services. And what a far cry from 30 or even 20 years ago. Last month, the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, NAMI, celebrated its 25th anniversary. NAMI emerged from a meeting in which a few isolated family support groups, 279 members from various states, came together at the University of Wisconsin at Madison to form a national organization. It was sponsored by the new community support program at NIMH and the Department of Psychiatry, and this small group of families rapidly expanded and grew exponentially into an organization that now claims over 200,000 families with over 1,200 affiliates in every state and most large cities. Prior to that, the major non-professional organization concerned with mental illness in the U.S. had been the National Mental Health Association, and at that time, the NMHA was a citizen, not a consumer organization, with a primary focus on promoting mental health. Certainly, it was concerned with serious mental illness, but its functions were largely limited to protection and advocacy at the legislative level. As an organization, its members were devoted to prevention of emotional disorders. They advocated for decent hospitals, community resources, etc. And today, the MHA devotes much more attention to serious mental illness with a special emphasis on consumer organization. And there are now, of course, numerous consumer organizations, both general and those targeting specific diagnoses, such as the DBSA. NAMI began as a family stakeholder organization with a focus on serious mental illness. And as we all know, today there's a well-functioning NAMI office in Arlington, Virginia, disseminating information and lobbying for research and services at the national as well as state level. The state NAMIs work for improved services in their individual states. The NAMI Consumer Council is a group of primary consumers who function as an interest group within NAMI with a very substantial role in policymaking. And during the past several years, at least one quarter of the members of NAMI's board of directors and two NAMI presidents have been consumers. On the national level, the organization has been powerfully influential in raising research dollars for mental illness. They've successfully lobbied for increases in congressional appropriations for NIMH research on the major psychiatric disorders, but this did not, I must admit, include BPD. NAMI was active in promoting passage of Public Law 99660, which required all 50 states to develop a comprehensive mental health plan, including provision of community care to persons with serious mental illness, and they've been a major force in lobbying for all kinds of other important legislation and for mental health parity. NAMI has also been instrumental in organizing private research foundations such as NARSED and the Ted and Vita Stanley Foundation. And there are numerous programs that educate its membership and the general public. Among them are the Family to Family program, a 12-week educational program on schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, major depression, developed by a psychologist and administered by highly trained family members. Over 35,000 families have taken this course, and it's available in most states, and I understand that additional materials on BPD is under discussion. A program for consumers is peer-to-peer, focusing on education, self-help, and recovery principle. I won't go into all of NAMI's many activities, but NAMI merges advocacy with education and self-help. All localities have support groups and membership education about all aspects of major mental illnesses. And most groups have engaged in public education and resource development, anti-stigma campaigns, and service on mental health planning, policy, and governance boards at local and national levels. Let me pause here for another personal recollection. Two, as a matter of fact. I used to chair the NAMI Curriculum and Training Network, and we've had a number of national conferences co-sponsored by NIMH and NAMI, which brought together leading clinical educators, research, and practitioners with family members for concept development and curriculum planning in the core professions, with an emphasis on getting more emphasis on serious mental illness into the core professions. Let me pause here for another personal recollection. Our Department of Psychiatry, like most, holds a weekly grand rounds, which consists of lectures for continuing education. And they're attended by our faculty, residents, mental health, hospital professional staff, as well as community psychiatrists. In the early 1980s, when I was organizing the NAMI conferences, I suggested to one of my colleagues that we have one session of grand rounds with family presenters talking about their experience of mental illness in the family. And he was genuinely puzzled. "But these are teaching sessions," he protested. "What can family members possibly teach us?" "You'll see," I said. We had a presentation with four kinship relationships, a wife, a mother, an adult child of two parents with mental illness, and a sibling. And all they did was talk about what it was like living with a person with schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, and yes, as I recall, BPD. What it was like dealing with the treatment system, how it felt to be shut out of communication, how ignorant they felt, and how much they wanted to know so they could help and not be impatient with their loved one. When it was over, there was total silence and then massive applause. One of the older community psychiatrists got up and said, "I've been coming to these grand rounds for 20 years, and this is the most important one of all, the one that has taught me the most." So try and get BPD family presenters into your clinical training programs. Now, BPD has been the poor cousin diagnosis in the field, one poorly understood and reluctantly treated by clinicians, and the least emphasized in public education. But families with BPD have been hungry for education. Although the primary diagnoses in the NAMI constituency were schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, many families with BPD were clearly represented. The Ask the Doctor sessions at the annual NAMI conference always included sessions on BPD, and they were always overflowing, and they continue to be. Now let's talk about the organizations specifically focusing on BPD. Of course, Perry has already told you a great deal about NEA BPD as a three-year-old nonprofit organization that has gained both national and international attention. And the mission to raise public awareness, provide education, I got all this material from Perry, to whom I'm indebted, is to provide education, promote research on BPD, and enhance the quality of life of those affected by this serious mental illness. And this is affected through efforts such as annual national and regional conferences, as well as the manualized family program called Family Connections. The organization has an outstanding scientific advisory board and more recently has been invited to enter a strategic partnership with NARSED. NEA BPD was also instrumental in the NIMH International Think Tank held in July 2004, where leading researchers met to discuss issues central to the disorder. Another important goal is to promote some support from NAMI. And there, over the year, there's been some success in this area. Perry also says, I think one other important issue for us is that we are in an alliance. And as is seen by the joint co-sponsoring of the conferences, we work to bring together partnering among organizations to further promote awareness of BPD. And I think this is an extremely important point. Family advocacy is tremendously important for attracting attention from professional organizations, from NIMH, from SAMHSA. NAMI and the Mental Health Association are omnibus organizations serving the interests of all persons with mental illness. In the case of an organization concentrating on a single diagnosis, partnering with larger family advocacy groups is essential. I might add that Perry, professional publications of Perry Hoffman, Alan Frusetti, and Charles Swenson, such as Dialectical Behavior Therapy, Family Skills Training, spreads the message and the techniques around to other clinicians working with persons with BPD. Many clinicians have come to the point where they recognize that the family should be involved, but at present there are only a few examples in the literature for doing so, and little in the way of hard research. Extending an evidence-based treatment modality like DBT to families provides the field with a new technology, which is much needed. The other older organization devoted to BPD is TARA, NAPD, the Treatment and Research National Advancements Association for Personality Disorder. And as we know, Valerie Pores has been a dynamic presence in this organization. And I'm indebted to her and to the association's literature for the following information. Founded in 1995, TARA NAPD, quote, raises awareness of BPD, advocates with legislators, mental health systems, and policymakers for parity for BPD with other major mental disorders and for appropriate treatment. TARA has a national helpline as a resource and referral center, and also a website with current information on BPD. I'm informed they also have an Ask the Doctor service with information available from some leading psychiatrists. And after training with Marsha Linehan, Valerie and other members are also offering an 8-week family education course featuring DBT techniques. And advocacy efforts have focused on more targeted research at NIMH, and they also hope to eliminate the distinction between major Axis 1 disorders and Axis 2, or personality disorders. A few other resources might also be mentioned. These can be accessed on the web, such as BPD Central and Helen's World of BPD Resources. There are probably others since I researched this, and I'm sure there are others I don't know about, and some of you could probably tell me about. Self-help resources, however, are supplements to the professional treatment system. Self-help groups need qualified professionals to provide the basic education and training, do the research, and expand the scope of services available to patients and their families within the treatment system itself. That's why political advocacy for professional resources must go hand in hand with self-help. Now let's talk about families' involvement in treatment. The critical issues here are, first, how does the service system conceptualize that involvement, and what are its parameters? Is the concept limited to offering family therapy or family psychoeducation? Are families seen as support systems for the patient, as important allies in the therapeutic endeavor? Do service providers also have an obligation to understand the impact of BPD on family members and to help lighten their burden? Do clinical training programs have an obligation to educate their students in evidence-based practices, one of which includes family psychoeducation as a deterrent to relapse? For many years in the psychiatric literature, the concept of family involvement in practically any kind of psychiatric disorder was limited to theories of etiology, that is, to the family's role in actually producing the illness. Psychodynamic approaches specifically eschewed any contact with the family because this might imply a betrayal of trust and contamination of the therapeutic alliance. These approaches do not involve other family members in the treatment process, and so far as I know, offer no education to alleviate their anxieties or teach them helpful modes of interacting with the patient. The early family systems approaches did involve the entire family, but focused on families' roles in maintaining the illness, on its functional value in the family economy. Thankfully, that era is just about over. However, rejection of theories of family causation simply means that poor parenting or dysfunctional interactions are not in themselves sufficient causes of mental illness, and I think Dr. Gunderson has pointed this out very clearly. But family interactions can certainly exacerbate or alternatively calm disturbed behaviors. Families can be trained to lower their expressed emotion, to change negative attitudes and attributions, to validate their relatives' right to define their own reality, and to make life easier for all concerned. And consumers also can be trained to recognize the impact of their BPD on family members, to recognize the stimuli that are particularly upsetting, and to educate their family members about their feelings. Family psychoeducation is one of the most carefully researched treatment modalities for schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, and is recognized as evidence-based practice, and there are also many examples in the literature now of psychoeducational work with families of persons with BPD, such as the multifamily groups and the work of Berkowitz and Gunderson, Glick and others also apply psychoeducational techniques in their family therapy for BPD, and Hoffman, Frusetti, and Swenson in their DBT family skills training. All of these clinician investigators have expanded the scope of their therapeutic approaches, but the essential elements are information, support, and illness management techniques. And this is rather different from family therapy models that view the illness as functional for maintaining a maladaptive family homeostasis. The older family systems approaches were often mystifying to families and sometimes reinforced their anxieties that they were somehow at fault. But the psychoeducational models are directly responsive to families' desires for education and behavior management strategies. But these efforts to work with families are unfortunately far from standard practice. Few families with BPD have been offered anything in the way of education or even therapy from the treatment system. At a family focus group session a few years ago, participants' concerns seemed to fall into two general categories, coping with the illness and coping with the treatment system. The system seemed more painful than the illness. Examples of statements included feeling traumatized by the system, misdiagnosis and minimization of symptoms, uncertain or multiple diagnoses, especially for BPD, inappropriate medications or titrating the right dosage levels, and confidentiality barriers. Families felt that multiple hospitalizations yielded little in the way of long-term benefit, and for some, jail seemed to be the only way to access treatment. Many families complained of mixed or inconsistent messages from professionals. Most of the families of BPT patients were relieved when they finally learned about DBT because they found the concept of the invalidating environment most beneficial. It gave them a useful way of modifying their own behavior. Here was a professional who finally taught them something they could do. In comparing families' experiences, how's my time? Okay. BPD seems more likely than other disorders to have been accompanied by multiple diagnoses or actual comorbidity. These families have had to deal with a large array of disturbed behaviors. Many parents of people with schizophrenia or bipolar disorder remember them as rewarding in their premorbid states. But parents of people with BPD seem to have contended with cognitive irrationality and mood swings since childhood or early adolescence. Histories of self-mutilation and suicidal attempts were more consistently symptomatic of BPD. Their different recollections suggested that parents of BPD children had few rewards and many torments throughout the life cycle and don't really expect things to get much better. What they seemed to get from the group interaction was understanding and confirmation rather than any easy answers. And it's a sad commentary that they got more from the group and a few concerned professionals than from all of the therapists their family members had seen over the years. Some research has demonstrated empirically the superiority of the group model in family psychoeducation and McFarland's model. And in an 18-year period of my working with individual families and multiple family groups, the group offers, first of all, an empathic understanding of the shared experience, and the members normalize typical reactions of fear, anger, guilt, and grieving. They share resource information and coping strategies. Over the years, I've seen group members provide a social network for isolated families and sometimes concrete aid for members' relatives in terms of jobs, social support, and even guardianship. They share examples of how they've been able to adapt their own behavior, change their attitudes, learn to interact more effectively with their ill member, and many provide success stories and reinforcement of hope and mastery. Many families want to be more actively involved in treatment. They want to learn the attitudes, techniques, and coping strategies that will most benefit their loved one, make life easier for themselves, and help them maintain the integrity of the family as a whole. But in order to do this, they need a treatment system that, first of all, honors BPD as a condition worth treating, and one that views family members as allies rather than as adversaries in this process. Families need a system that offers state-of-the-art education about the illness, training in therapeutic techniques, support, and honest communication. They need service providers who view confidentiality as ensuring patients' rights to make their own decision rather than erecting bureaucratic barriers to separate them from their support systems. And the HIPAA regulations are being sadly misused, as many of you know, adding to this problem. And they need clinicians who respect a simple fact about families, especially those who care enough to want to be involved. The persons in therapy are the clinicians' patients, but they are the family's loved ones. Not all the mistreatment in the world can alter that fact. Every family member here has had to resolve issues of anger, resentment, frustration, and often unjustified guilt, but they are still here because they love their relative with BPD and they want to help in any way they can. But we also know that much more is needed. We need more research on BPD, on etiology, biogenetic substrates, psychopharmacology, psychosocial factors, and the development and testing of more psychotherapeutic techniques. And for this, we need new funding commitments by NIMH, NARSAD, other private foundations, and this requires organization, lobbying, and voting strength. It requires a political advocacy movement because individual families can't do this alone. And we now have some precedents for how this is done. For the past 30 years, through lobbying and legislative action, family and consumer advocates have begun to speed the pace of basic etiological research, alter the shape of mental health law, eliminate disparities in insurance coverage for psychiatric conditions, reduce stigma by improving media portrayals of people with mental illness, and expand the parameters of treatment systems. They've had an impact on clinical training. They've been instrumental in helping research studies, from providing participants to refining informed consent forms. Coexisting with the professional mental health system, advocacy organizations have also offered social support, meaningful roles, and an accepting, destigmatizing milieu for persons who may need more than pharmaceutical or psychotherapeutic interventions to cope with their disabilities. I'll finish up quickly now.
Thank you.
I've mentioned the changing roles of families. Of course, we have many examples of changing roles of consumers and the way consumers are perceived and the emphasis, the influence of the consumer movement on the new recovery orientation in mental health services. This is a new era, a far cry from the days when persons with psychiatric disorders found treatment only in therapists' offices or in hospitals, and when treatment itself was bounded by the professional patient dyad, without regard to the social context in which the patient lived. We now realize that many persons in this social context, loving families, caregivers and mentors, concerned friends, and peers who have survived the same experience are also therapeutic resources. But families are the longest lasting of all. Perry Hoffman's allusion to partnering, the alliance of families and professionals, the ingathering of multiple resources may be the key to improved treatment and potential for recovery in the years ahead. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Lefley. And I think we now are ready for some questions. One, I think, is one of the questions, which is perhaps more a statement, but in case you wanted to add something to it, which is saying that the consumer initiative groups have a strong role and voice in this important awareness building and peer facilitation level of treatment to consumers and families and the general population. Please do not underestimate the value of the role of the consumer initiatives as we proceed.
I absolutely second that statement.
There's a difficult one, which is in working with families where the child is considered the identified patient, how is it best to address the parents' BPD?
The parents' BPD?
Parents.
The child is the identified patient, and yeah. The parents have BPD. Well, certainly that calls for a family therapy model, a family therapy intervention. I don't know of any that are really specific at the individual level for parental BPD. I would certainly find out if there is a BPD therapy group for family members in the area, and try and refer if there is a treatment available in the area for BPD patients, I would certainly refer the parents to that group or to that resource. Working with a child. It's a hard question to answer because you would have to know what are the child's symptoms. Is the child showing symptoms of BPD? Is the child showing symptoms of depression, of aggression and anger? I would ask the clinicians to address that question.
All right, thank you. Another question. You've well represented the potential benefits of family involvement in the treatment of borderline personality disorder and to appeal to the healing and supportive aspects of the family system. Of course, then we get the but. To what extent have you found it the case that family involvement is subversive, particularly in the instance of very enmeshed family systems with family members with severe narcissistic difficulties? For instance, if extent at all, what do you find is helpful to the families?
What do we do with the bad families? Again, these are issues I think that would have to be looked at on an individual basis and answered by a clinician. How is the enmeshment manifested? How is the enmeshment interpreted by the clinician who is working with the case? How is sabotage conceptualized by the clinician working with the case? There are all kinds of techniques, it seems to me, in family therapy for dealing with the family and for reframing so that to deal with the enmeshment and to deal with these pathological characteristics in the family that are standard family therapy techniques. But again, I would appeal to a clinician to answer that question, and it would have to be answered, I think, on an individual basis.
Well, I think we have a wonderful audience here that comes up with some very important questions that we don't have the immediate answer to, but appreciate your questions. Here's an easy one. What are the top three things a family of BPD should do?
A, take Perry Hoffman's course. No, A, join NEA BPD, first of all. B, take Perry Hoffman's course. And C, apply the techniques and skills that are learned both in the organization and in the Family Connections program. Read up on everything they can. Because a lot of the non-professional literature on BPD gives parents a lot of very helpful tips, I think, on how to handle the various situations in the family. Learn to be more accepting. Learn to understand. Try and understand the reality of the feelings that are being expressed by the person with BPD, et cetera. All the things that families are taught in the skills training programs can be applied, it seems to me, and people can learn about them fairly easily in an organization like this or in reading the popular literature on BPD.
Do you have any comments on or knowledge about what research or support is being done on early intervention or prevention, i.e. family parenting, parent training and development of BPD?
I don't.
Then there's a comment and question from someone who says, I'm the sister of a mentally ill person, and the daughter of a mentally ill person, and a professional therapist. I have lived on both sides of the fence. I'm a past president of NAMI, and I have very good parenting and sick parenting. Are we getting mixed messages about how parents contribute to the etiology of BPD?
Let me understand the question. Had good parenting and...
This person has had both good parenting
and
bad parenting. And the question is, are we getting mixed messages about how parents contribute to the etiology of BPD?
I think throughout the history of psychiatric theory, there have been mixed messages. And they've been mixed mainly because we didn't know enough at the time. Research points in one direction. Theoretical models point in one direction. A body of research arises, not very good research, arises to confirm it. Then other better research disconfirms it. This is the history of science, actually, and of scientific advances. So if your impression from the literature is that bad parenting causes BPD, and that good parenting is going to save you from BPD, and you're right there in the middle, and you've had experience with both, you're going to be very puzzled by what you hear from clinicians or what you read in the literature. From what we know now, parenting is not the primary etiological factor in development of PPD, BPD. There is a genetic component, there is a biological component, and so forth. The way parents respond to individual children has a lot to do with the emergence of the disorder, if there's a biological predisposition, et cetera. Can a good parent save you from bad parenting? I don't think so. But its role in the development of the disorder is still very much problematic.
There's one final question we have time for, but I don't think that you would have the answer, and that is, where in the LA area are groups and or family groups available for BPD patients?
I think you can learn that here at this conference.
I think that they'd be able to network and find out here from those who are here in Los Angeles, sign-in sheets provided. And I want to very much thank Dr. Lefley for a wonderful presentation.
Thank you.